Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, we love that music, but we don't have the time. I can't thank you enough, gentlemen. This is Blog Talk Radio, syndicated news. We're spending the evening with Raymond Rivas and Louis Schiff. I see you're both here.
Yes, happy to be here.
Thank you, gentlemen. I have to stop a moment and thank these lovely gentlemen. We had a technical difficulty earlier in the evening. We had scheduled the program for 9 p.m., and for whatever reason, there was a little glitch that wouldn't allow us to go forward, and these wonderful gentlemen were so gracious that they were in agreement to move our segment to 11 p.m. I can't thank you enough for that courtesy.
Well, you know, the clock does not stop for good ideas and good talk.
Thank you so much. What a lovely way to see it. That's a lovely way to view it. Well, Louis Schiff has written three fantastic books, The Armchair Millionaire, The Millionaire's Companion, and now The Middle Class Millionaire. And Raymond Rivas is going to be with us again. He's going to be joining us to talk about high wealth maintenance for families who need that kind of help. Raymond, are you with us? He's going to come back soon. In any case, turn your radio down. Oh my! Well, we'll shut that off. Anyway, let's talk about these books. How are The Middle Class and The Middle Class Millionaire different?
Well, I'll start with how they're similar to some extent, because what makes them worth looking at in the same sentence are that they both came from middle-class homes. It's surprising to a lot of people, but most of the wealthy in America, these people we imagine in our head living this wonderful first-class lifestyle, actually came from the middle class. That's the overwhelming amount of wealthy people come from the middle class. So we wanted to know, why is it that some people who start out in the middle class stay in the middle class, and why is it that others, a small number of them, but a big enough number that it's worth looking at, we're talking about 9 million households, why is it that these 9 million households who start out in the middle class peel themselves off and join the wealthy? What's the difference? What's going on between these two groups?
Absolutely. What is the difference? Tell us.
Well, it's not in the usual ways people would think. It is not in the schools they went to, because they went to the same schools. It's not even in the level of education reached, because, in fact, there seems to be a negative correlation between the level of education reached and wealth creation. In other words, master's degrees and PhDs, not only do they not get you closer to creating wealth, in some ways they hurt you. So they're going to the same schools, they're growing up in the same towns, in the same households, with the same social values, but these 9 million households are peeling themselves off, and the reason is because of four qualities that we dig into in great detail in the book, but we call these four qualities millionaire intelligence. They're not taught in school. They're things that you might hear and say, oh, sure, of course that's a good thing. But what people don't realize is the impact that these four qualities have on wealth creation. And it's only getting more developed. And by that I mean the middle class that seems to be staying in the middle class seems to be unaware that these are the skills and behaviors that it takes to create wealth. And the middle class millionaires who are exhibiting them seem to be creating wealth faster and faster. There's all sorts of implications about that, like how we have a two-class society, even within the middle class. But what's really happening is when people will often talk about the rich and everyone else, is that in some ways that's only growing because the skills it takes to become rich, wealth is finding that those people faster.
My gosh. I didn't realize that.
So I'll whenever you're ready, I'll tell your audience what those four are, but will you tell
yes.
me when we want to give that information out, because that's the best information of all.
And in 45 minutes, when you're just about to close, is when you're going to give it to them. Don't give
exactly.
them the dessert before the dinner.
Exactly.
What does it mean to be middle class nowadays? What does that mean anymore?
Well, that's a great question, and you know, the fact is, I'm open to every one of the definitions. I have come across a lot. One is the income you make, and we used $50,000 to $80,000 household incomes as middle class incomes. Now, in certain parts of the country, they'll hear that number and they'll say that's not middle class. That's way too low. And in other parts of the country, that sounds right. What's interesting to note is that $50,000 is roughly the median income in America, meaning half of American households make more than $50,000 and half make less. So it's technically the middle. But what we really did was we went from $50,000 and we went up from there till we hit 20% of the population. Between the $50,000 and $80,000 household band, you'll find 20% of the population, beginning with the median. So that's how we went about doing it. Now, there's other ways. There, people will say you have a white-collar job that makes you middle class, but you know, there's all sorts of problems with that. I mean, there are blue-collar workers who make more than white-collar workers, so it doesn't quite add up. There are people who will say it's the house you grew up in. If you grew up in a middle-class house, then you're a middle-class person. Or they'll just say it's your values. If you want to call yourself middle-class, that's what you are. And there's economic descriptions, there's sociological descriptions. I think we ended up in when we thought about it a lot for the purposes of the book, we ended up with the literary description. And the literary description, which bears itself out in all of our data, is that middle-class families design their lives around sacrificing for the benefit of the next generation. That middle-class families are uniquely focused on upward mobility, and if that's how they decide where they're going to live, what they're going to spend their money on, what values they hold dear to pass on to their children. And that doesn't appear quite as prominently in either working-class families or in the very wealthy families. So we define middle-class ultimately as families who are really designing their lives and prioritizing their lives around upward mobility for the next generation.
So that's their secret.
You know, in a lot of ways it's their secret, yes, because they make a lot of decisions about how to live their life based on something that's so fundamental. Interestingly, as you look at lower levels of wealth, call them working-class families, and you look at very, very wealthy families, 25 million and above, you'll start to see that their own personal interests and hobbies start to become more important to them. The middle-class millionaire really doesn't have time for things like personal interests and hobbies. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, we could certainly debate. But their lives are really based on two things: succeeding in business and creating the most positive environment they can for their children. And again, we can debate what it means to create a positive environment too. But they don't have time for any other interests or hobbies. They're totally focused on those two things. And the middle class and the working class and the very, very wealthy seem to have an interest in their own personal development in ways that you don't find in the middle class millionaire.
Wow. I guess it's going to change everything. It's going to change the economy as we know it. What does it mean to have $1 million these days? Does it mean anything anymore?
It's a great question, and you know, the truth is, if you ask a room filled with people whether it would change their life to have $1 million, you know, people who don't have it would say, yes, it would change my life. And people who do have it say, didn't change my life at all. So the notion that $1 million is this fantasy number that will make all your problems go away and will give you some sort of a first-class lifestyle and you know, your life will be easier, is absolutely not borne out by the people who have it. There are things that money does get you, but it's not even a quarter of what people think it is in terms of quality of life.
Oh my.
Now, some people say,
Louis, I had no idea. Yeah, you think about it because you don't have it.
Right. Some people say that the way we think of $1 million is actually $10 million now. That if you have $10 million, your life gets really good and things get much easier. And so we have to change. There's no good word for that. You know, to be a 10 millionaire doesn't sound as good as, you know, do you want to be a millionaire? But it's the same idea. It takes $10 million to really be on easy street in that kind of mythical sense of the word.
Louis, this is fantastic. Now, do you think everybody wants to be wealthy? Does everybody really want to be wealthy?
That's a great question, Ruthie, because what I have learned are that most people want to be wealthy, and what they're willing to do to be wealthy, though, is very different. I can tell you this. The middle-class millionaire both wants to be wealthy, and they seem to be willing to do anything, short of the being dishonest or unethical, to reach wealth. The middle class tell us they want to be wealthy. They even tell us they expect to be wealthy, which is kind of a funny thing. But they don't actually act on the things it takes to create wealth. They tell us what it takes to create wealth. They seem to have a pretty good grasp on it, but they simply don't act on it. So I think that there's a certain amount of, you know, it's worthwhile to spend a little time being truthful with ourselves. If you want to be wealthy, but you're really not willing to do what it takes to be wealthy, then you're in a fantasy mode, and that's okay, because fantasizing about wealth is a fun thing. But don't be confused about the actual outcomes you're experiencing. If you're not creating wealth, I'll give you a perfect example. Most people think that if I went to college and I got a good job and I work hard, I'll be able to live really well. Well, that just doesn't cut it anymore. Actually, the old middle-class model, working hard with a good degree in a good company, doesn't actually get you a middle-class life anymore. So people who say, how come because I did everything right, I went to school, I work hard, I got a good job at a good company, how come it's not happening for me? They're missing the point. That's not how wealth creation takes place anymore, and they're not going to experience wealth creation. And it's okay. You can say, well, look, here's what my life has turned out to be. Good job, like the people I work with, I like what I do, and I can basically maintain my family. But get rid of the fantasy about creating wealth, because that's not going to happen with that lifestyle.
That changes our thinking. I mean, for most people.
I think so. I think that there's people who read The Middle Class Millionaire, and I encourage your listeners to do it, because they can come away with one of a few conclusions. One is, I like the sound of this, and now I know more about how to do it, because the book is based on primary data. We surveyed 3,700 households to draw our conclusions. They can also come away with it and say, I don't like those people. I don't want to live my life that way. And the third they could, because, you know, look, I mean, they're not bad people by any means. In fact, the focus of the book is really how this group is actually very innovative. And actually, they're kind of a gatekeeper population for the rest of the middle class, because the middle class is watching them. So they're watching what kind of cars they drive. They're watching where they go on vacation. They're watching where they send their kids to school. And to a large extent, the middle class tries to emulate them because they're viewed as the successful people. You know, the old phrase, keeping up with the Joneses.
Absolutely.
But others might read this book and say, I see what it takes. I see what that life is like. And I choose otherwise. And I think that that's a very healthy conclusion to reach. And it would help people get out of this fantasy mode that, you know, I'll give you an example. In our survey, we asked people, do you think you could become wealthy by having a job that you love?
And what do they say?
Middle class people say, yes. If I love my job, wealth will follow it. Middle class millionaires say no. Middle class millionaires say, find a way to make a lot of money, and you'll love that. Doesn't matter what it is. If it makes you a lot of money, you'll find a way to love it. Middle-class people say, I want to do the job I love to do most, and I want somehow for it to make me rich. Well, the problem is, what if you're that chemistry high school teacher who loves his job and really does contribute to the community, but you're not going to get rich as a chemistry high school teacher. So stop thinking that that's going to happen. And focus on what other, you know, values and benefits and rewards you can get from your life. Don't have a wealth fantasy.
My gosh. Wow. Now, let's see. If you had a lot of money, I mean, maybe not a million, but 5 million, 10 million, would it really change your life? Would it affect you, or not at all?
You know, we're finding a couple things. One is that the more money you have, starting after 10 million, and really the group we look at is 25 million and above. Mm-hmm. If you start to have 25 million or more, your life starts to become different enough from the people you grew up with that it's hard for you to be equals among them anymore. So we're finding that what we call the ultra wealthy, 25 million and above, they're going to start moving into a different community. They're going to live in one of those gated communities because it's more comfortable for them to be around other people like themselves in terms of how much wealth they've created. But other things start to change too. You'll start to see that middle, ultra wealthy people become much more protective of everything around them. They, for example, if they have a service provider in their life, let's say they have a financial advisor that they really like, or a personal trainer that they really like, they're going to view sharing information about that personal trainer as potentially losing them, because they live in a community where someone's going to try and poach their personal trainer. Because people have money and they try to acquire things, and the best thing to acquire when you're rich is something that you can take from someone else, and then, you know, then you have it and they don't. So ultra wealthy families start to become very segregated, and they start to wall themselves off from the rest of the community. But we saw in our data that people who had less than that, and we really capped it at 10 million, people who have $1 million to $10 million, essentially millionaires, you know, wealthy people, still tend to live in the neighborhoods that they lived in before. They tend to live in what would be called middle-class neighborhoods. They may have the nicest house on the street, but they tend to live on the street with other people who are clearly middle-class people. And they circulate with them, and they work with them, and they socialize with them. So, for example, the difference would be, take a Fortune 500 CEO, a wealthy, successful person. Well, that Fortune 500 CEO doesn't see anybody during the week that doesn't either work for them or isn't heavily scheduled into their daily agenda. But then take a CEO of a company with 50 employees. Well, that CEO may be worth, you know, millions of dollars, maybe $10 million. But that CEO probably knows the names of most, if not all, their employees, and probably walks among them, and they probably go to lunch together, and they're with each other. And so that CEO of a 50-person company who has significant wealth is in the community, and people see him or her, and they see what he's driving or where she's vacationing, and they're exposed to that person. But that Fortune 500 CEO, that person is, that's fantasy land. That's someone in another stratosphere, and people have a lot harder time relating to that person.
I see that the families will change as that money grows and that income is, those new revenue streams are coming in. It's going to change the life. And I do see families getting a little more cloistered as their wealth builds. I do see that.
Definitely. It's kind of a, you know, we live in a funny world where we want it to be an egalitarian society, where we want us all to start off on an equal footing, and that's a very American idea, and a wonderful one. And then we have another concept which we call a meritocracy, which is everybody should be able to go as far as they're able to go, as far as their talents and their skills and their temperaments will allow them. But we kind of have a problem when people pull ahead too far. Then we start to lose touch with them, and then all, some of our own resentments will come out. And so this group of people who are creating wealth, there's this wonderful moment that we identify in the middle-class millionaire where they're still with us, but they're kind of different. Then there's the very, very wealthy. And the problem is that most people, if you ask them to name a rich person, they're going to name, you know, the usual suspects. They're going to name Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and Donald Trump. And they're not, and those are stratospherically wealthy people. They're less than, you know, they're 0.001% of the population. They're not going to name that person who owns the 10 dry cleaning stores in their neighborhood or owns the 50-person technology firm in their neighborhood, because they don't think of that person as wealthy. But they do know that that person's very successful. The truth is that they have a lot more to learn, they have a lot more access to that person in their community than these sort of two-dimensional fantasy celebrity versions of wealth. And there's much more to be gained by tapping into that knowledge in the middle-class millionaire than there is by watching Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous and imagining and fantasizing that one day that'll be your life.
Now, I wanted to ask you about middle-class millionaire parents. How do they feel about their kids growing up with that wealth?
Right. You know, that's probably one of the biggest areas of discomfort and uncertainty for middle-class millionaires, because the truth is, and we haven't talked about the four skills or qualities that make people wealthy yet, millionaire intelligence.
Yeah, not yet.
Let's make sure to do that. But I can tell you that they're not, again, they're not the kind of things you're going to learn in school, public school, private school, any kind of school. They're things that are, they're behaviors and attitudes. And middle-class millionaires tend to have these behaviors and attitudes in greater amounts than the rest of the middle class. Their fear is that their children won't have it. Their fear is that their children won't inherit the work ethic that is so fundamentally behind the creation of wealth in these houses. Instead, they'll inherit something called the wealth ethic, which is every parent's greatest fear, that the kid will grow up spoiled and will grow up expecting and having a sense of entitlement. Well, that's a fear for any parent. But you know what? It becomes more realistic or more possible when the kid is growing up in you know, luxurious circumstances, or at least circumstances where money is not really a problem. And so parents are terrified about this. And middle-class billionaire parents, because they want their kids to have the same ethics and behaviors and attitudes that they had, are going to great lengths to make that possible. Those lengths are changing education as we know it. They're changing the prestigious colleges. They're changing the process to get kids into those colleges. They're changing the mission of those colleges. And these schools, you can say the 50 most prestigious schools, which lead the rest of the nation in terms of how schools are designed and developed, are changing radically to support and serve middle-class millionaire parents. Whether you like that or not, whether that scares you or not, schools in this country are focusing on making middle-class millionaire parents happy. And the way they're doing it is by saying, we're going to try and teach your kids the same things that you think made you successful. And that's happening all over the country in a big way. And it's changing education as we know it.
I had no idea. That's alarming. We had no idea.
Well, it's
that is that's very interesting.
You know, things change. Things like education change. I mean, even in the course of a century, what people went to school for in the beginning of the 20th century and what they were going to school for at the end of the 20th century changed radically. But we're in a great change again, and I would date this change to about, it's almost 20 years now, where schools have really been gearing themselves towards the mindset of the middle-class millionaire even more than kind of the old notions of erudition and liberal arts and things like that. And so there is a big change underfoot, and it could probably give you pause. But the truth is it's really directly related to the concerns of these wealthy parents.
But wait a minute. If you're saying that the nation's prestigious colleges are changing the way they look at high school candidates who apply there in those communities, what are they expecting?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, think about this. The kids applying to college today, and the top 1%, the top 3%, the top 5% of students are remarkably similar in their story. Their story is usually that they are third or fourth generation college. Okay, these kids, this is not the first generation. They're not even the second. These kids have been surrounded by college-educated parents, grandparents, great-grandparents their entire lives. That makes them so incredibly well-prepared for college compared to a kid who's first generation or even second generation. So you've got kids that are extremely well-prepared. And what does that mean? It means that their parents have been planning out their college resumes since they were born. So they've had all these great extracurricular activities. They have perfect SAT scores. They have great grades. They've been part of all the right clubs and societies. They can get recommendations from all the right people. And they're all applying to the same 50 schools. So what does it take for a kid to get into the school these days? It takes more than perfect grades, more than a great extracurricular background. It actually takes the very skills that the schools need to see in the students that have made middle-class millionaires successful. What schools want today, if you have all those other things, great grades, you're the valedictorian, you're the lead in a school play and all that, what they want from you is they want you to contribute to campus life. They want you to be a personality. They want you to have character. They want you to have all these qualities which will show you to be a leader on campus and add to campus life. What they don't want is the nerd who sits in the library all day who gets straight A's, because that person who doesn't really participate socially is really not adding to campus life. Sure, they're getting a good education, but they're not contributing to the school. Part of the reason they want those kids to be that way is because they want the students, when they leave the college, to be leaders. And if they're leaders, they're going to become middle-class millionaires. And if they're leaders, they're going to reflect very well on the school. So when people walk around and say that they're Pepperdine graduates or Swarthmore College graduates or any one of these great schools, people will say, wow, that must be a good school. Look at these great people that came from that school. And more to the point, those people will become leaders, they'll become role models for people who want to go to that school later, and they'll become funders so that they'll become contributors as alumni. So they're really creating a generation of future middle-class millionaires. There's too many kids with great grades, great records. Now they're looking for leaders. Now they're looking for the people who break out of the mold, who stand out, who show character, who show leadership.
Now, in your last book, you talk about the tear-down phenomenon as being part of the middle-class millionaire trend. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. It's an interesting thing. I think for your listeners who want to find a way to create wealth, who listen to this and say, you know, I want to become a middle-class millionaire myself, here's my advice. You can become a middle-class millionaire by serving middle-class millionaires. They're very busy people. They've got very complex lives. Find a way to add value to their life, and you could become wealthy too. There's all sorts of examples of physicians who design their practices around these clients and of all sorts of practitioners. But if you're not a physician, then I'll tell you the story about the company called Entremanure. Entremanure picks up the dog poop in your community so that you don't have to. There's all sorts of ways to help these people. So teardowns are a phenomenon that people have all sorts of opinions about. They say that these McMansions are coming in and they're really affecting the character of the community. Well, really, teardowns are led by middle-class millionaires, and it's really a convergence of the middle-class millionaire phenomenon, because these middle-class millionaires, these ambitious, successful people who move into these communities, and they tear the house down and they build a new, super bigger house, they represent the newest, most cutting-edge version of middle-class life today. It's new. It's different. Not everyone likes what it looks like, but it is the latest and greatest in middle-class life today. And what happens from those types of houses will find their way into other houses. You may not like that McMansion on the corner that appeared on your street, but it made your house more valuable. And it made your house more valuable because another middle-class millionaire family will buy your house, tear it down, and do the very same thing. They're creating greenhouses. They're creating ecologically sound houses. They're creating modern, smart houses. And they're creating big houses. And some people even think they're ugly houses. But the fact is, that's middle-class life today. The 1950s ranch home that served families very well 30 and 40 years ago is not the kind of household living that the middle-class millionaire wants. That kind of disruptive quality, I've now given two examples. They're disrupting the education system, and they're disrupting the way we live in our homes. There's other examples, but when you look at all the examples which we outline in the book, they're always core middle-class things. They're always about how you live, how you raise your children, how you take care of yourself, how you view your profession, even how you enjoy yourself. You're going to see that they're always core middle-class qualities, but the middle-class millionaire is reinventing them. In the case of the teardown, they're gentrifying your neighborhood, whether you like it or not. You may not like being on the other end of it, but that's called gentrification.
Wow. Now, something that really interests us here at Syndicated News, and by the way, let's take a moment to announce that this is Blog Talk Radio, Syndicated News, and we're talking to Lewis Schiff. He's written three wonderful, wonderful books, The Armchair Millionaire, The Middle Class Millionaire, and The Middle Class Companion. And these books were bestsellers. They're very, very interesting, and he's changing the way we think about money, absolutely. And we're talking here. We're going to hear four very, very important points soon, but not yet, not quite yet. There's still a lot more we want to know from Mr. Lewis Schiff here. Healthcare. We had a program. We had a round diabetes roundtable, and it was very interesting. And everyone's talking about it, and they're sharing the clip. And it was so big. I had no idea that diabetes so affected everyone. I mean, so every family. Just about you find it in just about every family. And I didn't realize that healthcare mattered so much to everyone. And we're going to have to do the diabetes roundtable again. It was that important that we're going to have to talk about many other things that we couldn't cover in an hour. And I said to them, an hour and a half actually, it went by in seconds. You're talking about a healthcare revolution with the middle class millionaire, and they're driving it, and they can potentially change healthcare for everybody. Is it the same way they're affecting the academic situation? They're affecting the universities? Are they going to affect healthcare?
I think that they're going to have an effect on healthcare, which is has the potential to change everything about it. Every one of us can relate to the indignities that we all experience, the disjointed healthcare experience that we all have. Our primary care physician doesn't really talk to our specialists. We go for these tests. We don't really know what the tests are for. If you really are sick, it's very hard to get the healthcare system to coordinate its care for you to make sure that you have a really good experience. And that's sickness. What about wellness? There was this concept 25, 30 years ago, these health maintenance organizations said something to us. They made a bold promise, which was, what if we keep you even healthier? If we help you lose weight, if we help you exercise, what if we do all those things for you and we incent you, we pay you to do them, then there'll be less sick people around and that'll bring healthcare costs down. Well, the HMOs came up with a very different formula. They realized that if they just pay for the small number of people who get really sick, that's actually cheaper than trying to keep us healthy. That's not good for America. That is the
diabetes. Wait a minute.
Phenomenon.
Say that again. That's so important. It's got to be repeated. Say that again, please.
I'll give you an example. The screening test it takes to find some early forms of cancer are much more expensive than just waiting till someone gets the cancer and treating that one person. We should all be getting all these different types of tests that can be done so easily now. In fact, I profile a blood test where they'll take a little bit of your blood and they'll check it for 250 different diseases. But the problem is it's a $3,500 test, and the healthcare companies don't want to pay that $3,500. They'd rather wait until that small minority of people get a disease or another disease or another disease and pay for the care of that person. They're not paying for wellness. They're paying for sickness. There are a bunch of doctors that now are called concierge physicians who have a very different model. The typical healthcare system, as we all know, we go to see our doctor, we get a few minutes with that doctor before he or she sends us on to a specialist. That doctor is a gatekeeper, and part of the role is to figure out whether money is being spent correctly. Should I send this patient for an MRI? Should I send this patient for a prescription or an X-ray? That primary care physician is a gatekeeper, really working on behalf of the HMO. The concierge physician takes that model, completely turns it upside down. The patients pay as much as several thousand dollars a year to become a patient in a concierge healthcare practice. These practices have limited numbers of patients. The typical number of patients in a typical primary care practice is about 2,000 to 2,500. In a concierge practice, it's more like 600 patients, and the fees could be something like $1,500, $1,800 a year.
Wow.
For that $1,500 a year, you're getting a lot more time from your primary care physician. They will spend much more time with you, and they'll actually work on wellness. Instead of seeing 20 patients a day, they'll see 5 patients a day, and they'll divide their time up differently. What's happening are that the wealthier class, this is the middle class millionaires are doing this, because not everyone has $1,800 a year to spend on this. But the middle-class millionaire is creating a model where they're taxing themselves. They're actually coming up with an additional healthcare tax, and they're paying it, these $1,800 a year fees. But in return, they're getting better healthcare. So now this has been going on for about 10 years, and all the data suggests that patients who get to spend more time with their doctors, get to know their doctors better, and can follow their doctor's instructions more closely, are actually healthier. They're actually healthier. So now your $1,800 a year is making you healthier. So if you're healthier, you're going to use the healthcare system less. And that's the good news. So now a lot of people, venture capitalists, have seen this and said, this is a plan worth funding. How can we bring concierge healthcare from $1,800 a year down to $500 a year, down to $250 a year? So there's some experiments going on right now, backed by venture capital, in downtown urban neighborhoods that are bringing concierge health care to patients for something like $50 a month. Okay, now we're talking about working with all the uninsured, and we're talking about a system that can actually be better than universal health care. this is very disruptive, so much so that all of my friends in the concierge healthcare industry have said that they are getting phone calls from the presidential candidates saying, tell us about this thing. This might be a solution. And what's so funny about it is that it's just good old-fashioned medicine. You know, if you ask someone from 75 years ago, they'd say, sure, I had a doctor when I was growing up. When we went to see the doctor, we paid the doctor for whatever he or she did for us, and that was it. That's really what this is. This is basically having a relationship with one doctor, paying them, they take care of you, health care is better, people are well, they're not sick, and it's a wonderful phenomenon.
Well, Lewis, how can somebody become a middle-class millionaire if they aren't one already?
Okay, it's called millionaire intelligence. So that's the phrase that's the name we gave it, because every time we look at this group of people, we see four qualities that stand out.
Now's the time to give us those four qualities. We want to hear them.
Okay. Number one, they work a lot harder than the rest of us. On average, they work 70 hours a week compared to 40 hours a week. On average, they take 12 vacation days a year instead of 19 vacation days a year. They are hardworking. The most successful people in America are also the hardest working people in America. There is no substitute, in many ways, for good old-fashioned hard work. These are people who wear the Blackberries. These are the people who take time during the weekends to work. They report that they're available at night and on weekends for business. 70 hours a week is a lot of work. That's a lot of hours, and that's the average. So they are definitely putting in the hours, and whether you like the idea of working hard or not, that is a core quality of successful people. That's the toughest one of all, I think. Maybe not. Maybe this one's tougher. Persevering in the face of adversity. We have asked middle-class millionaires and middle-class people alike, how often have you had a significant professional or career failure? Middle-class millionaires report twice as often failing as the middle class. This takes a second to figure out. The most successful people in America fail more often than the less successful people. Out of failure, the most important lessons are learned. My friend Raymond Rivas is calling us today from the Silicon Valley of California, where failure is a part of how business gets done. And in some ways, you're judged by how many failures you have, but you're not really judged in how many failures. You're judged with how you handled failure. And that's where we see the difference. Middle-class millionaires, when we ask them, what's your most common response to a professional setback or failure, their answer was, we tried again in a different way. Middle-class people, when we ask them, what was your most common response to failure, their answer was, we gave up and focused on other projects. It's as if middle-class millionaires, upon hearing about a failure or experiencing a failure, say, aha, now I know one way not to do it. Let's try some other ways. And middle-class people fail, and they say, you know, that's a sign. That's a sign that I should never have tried to begin with. Completely different response to the same experience. Perseverance in the face of adversity. We're in the middle of a very tough economy. Middle-class millionaires are doubling down. They're making a harder effort. They're putting their nose to the grindstone. I see a lot of middle-class people saying, I'm just going to hope I keep my job, keep my head out of harm's way, and wait till this passes. That is not what middle-class millionaires are doing. They're confronting.
What are they doing?
They're confronting adversity. They're renegotiating with their clients. They're renegotiating with their vendors and their employees. They're buying businesses. That CEO of a 50-person business I described earlier, he's going to be looking to buy his competitors in a tough market. That's what they do. They actually see these moments, and they see who's weak around them, and they try to jump on the opportunity. They're persevering in the face of adversity. The third quality is a really important one, and it's part of something we call the influence of affluence, because this notion of keeping up with the Joneses is a real thing. What happens are that middle-class people watch the middle-class millionaires in their community. I said this earlier. They watch what they drive. They watch where they go on vacation. They're also watching how they make career decisions or investing decisions. They're being watched. The middle-class puts the middle-class millionaire on a pedestal. When we survey the middle-class millionaire, they report that they experience this too. They report that they're asked for advice all the time. They report that they seem to know about what's happening in the community more than other people do. Middle-class millionaires use information and relationships as a way to create wealth. middle-class people and middle-class millionaires both started out in the same household. Neither of them had money. Middle-class millionaires use information as if it were an asset. What they can learn from you, what they can learn from Raymond, casual conversation, what's the opportunity, how can I turn that into a business opportunity or money for me? Middle-class millionaires are engaged in a high-level conversation, and it's all about sharing information with you and then asking you to share information with me.
Okay, in that case, you mentioned Raymond Rivas, who's, I believe he's here with us now, aren't you, Raymond?
I certainly am, Ruthie.
Say hello to your friend, Louis Schiff. He's with us tonight.
Hi, Louis. How are you?
Good, Raymond. How are you?
Very good. Thank you.
I would have to say that.
Engaging conversation, isn't he?
It's amazing.
If I
were going to mention the person who makes the most connections that I know, I would have to say that would be Ricardo Alcaraz, who is constantly connecting this one to that one to this one to that one, and I believe he'll make us all wealthy simply because he reminds me of an orchestra leader, a band leader.
Well, that sounds right. That sounds like what these people are. They're engaged in an orchestra of information around them.
Oh, and by the way, I hang on to Ricardo Alcaraz's pant leg because I see that he knows how to make all these connections. And I keep telling everyone, he's going to make us wealthy. Hang on there. He will.
That's funny.
I've got to meet guy, I'll tell you. I'll introduce you.
I will introduce you.
Good.
He's the one who orchestrated all that synergy with the group from Pennsylvania that then he connected with the law firm from China and New York. And, oh, my goodness, he makes my head spin, but he's so smart. He gets all these. He has us all dancing.
Wonderful.
And the fourth one, there's another one. You gave us three.
Okay, yes. The fourth one is, so I've talked about hard work. I talked about perseverance. I talked about networking and tapping into the flow of information and collaborating with people around you. The fourth is working in your own enlightened self-interest. That means you have to look out for number one. There's all sorts of ways that reveals itself, but you can never forget that you have to put yourself ahead of everyone else.
I can't tell you how many times I've said that, and I'm Latin, and in a Latin context, when a woman says that, they say, oh, she's so selfish. But if a man would say the same things I say, they'd say, oh, attaboy. Yeah, that's great.
Right.
Get, keep going. But because I'm a woman, they want me to, I don't know, leave the room and go cook something. Oh, it makes me crazy when they say, oh, you shouldn't be that strong. You shouldn't be that fierce. You shouldn't. Yes, I should. That's how I built businesses. That's how I made successes of things that were failures. And I tell you, I didn't give up. I never give up. I never give up. And I think that's my quality that keeps me going. I will not stop until I stop breathing. I just won't.
That's the formula. That's it. I mean, you're Ruthie, you have it because, you know, there's all sorts of times when you could try and make everyone feel good or you can try and make everyone have a great experience. But if you haven't already, before you ever started something, said, what does it mean to me? What am I looking for out of this? What's the success definition for me? You're never going to get it. And whether it's, you know, a business venture or a career or a negotiation, you have to be very clear that this has to be about you. And people who do that win. People who do that come out on top. There's just no two ways about it.
I am so happy you said that. You made my day. I am so happy you said that.
Now, you'll notice that none of those things are complicated. I mean, they take
no.
a lot of fortitude, but they don't take a lot of brains. You don't have to go to Harvard to learn how to persevere. You don't have to go to Harvard to learn how to work real hard or to put yourself first. So these are what we're always seeing are that the reason I said education has a kind of a reverse correlation, you know, you got a lot of C students out there who have those four qualities and are doing very well in business. And then you've got
Absolutely.
A lot of, you know, A students who graduate from Harvard who are smart as a whip, but they don't have that kind of that kind of toolbox that really takes to be successful.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Well, this is Blog Talk Radio, syndicated news, and we've spent the evening with Louis Schiff. He's been telling us about the wonderful ways to become a middle-class millionaire and then some. And you've got to get the book. It's right on our website. Go to the segment. It's right there. You click the button, and you can buy it right there. It's available right on our site.
Yep.
Actually, all three of his books are up there. So please feel free. Buy them all if you need. But you might as well have a tool because even having a million by the time your kids grow up, say 10, 15 years from now, won't be enough.
No.
It just won't be enough.
No, it's a good start.
Thank you for joining us this evening. You have graced our little studio. I tell you, we've learned so much.
Oh, that's good.
And
now you're going to learn.
Yes.
You're going to learn a lot more from Raymond Rivas when he tells you about the ultra wealthy, because Raymond and I have the great honor to work together on some of the most successful people in Silicon Valley, and we're working on these projects together. I've got a background in working with these types of clients. Raymond, they know him and they love him and they know that he's the go-to guy for getting problems solved. And he and I'm in New York, he's in California, but we found each other and we got a lot of great projects going on right now, and I'm thrilled that your listeners are going to get to hear from this man so that when they get to their first $25 million, they know who to call.
Oh, what a lovely intro.
Thank you for a better segue.
Thank you, Louis.
Sure. Have a great time, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Well, what an evening that was. What an eye-opener. I hope you all took notes. I couldn't type fast enough. I was trying to collect everything he was saying. It was marvelous. Marvelous. So, this is now Raymond Rivas. He manages these families and helps them keep all that wealth together and make sure that they protect themselves, even if something goes wrong. And he's going to tell us all about that, aren't you?
Exactly. Would you like me to kind of give you an introduction to what I do?
I want to know what a high net worth specialist is, because I know that that's what you are. And
yes.
Tell me what you do. That's what everyone calls you. When I ask, what is he? And they say, he's the go-to guy if you've got a lot of money. He'll teach you how to protect it, and he'll teach you how to keep it together.
Okay, well, what do you do? What I
do
specifically is when you become that multi or the middle-class millionaire like Louis was talking about,
mm-hmm.
Now someone's got to protect you. And so therefore what I do is I take clients who have high net worth. They might be worth $10 million, $20 million, $50, $100 million. And what they want to do are two things. Number one, they want to find out how to cut down their income taxes on the portfolios that they currently have. They don't want to. They want to pay their fair share of income taxes, but they don't want to pay more than their fair share. Number two, what they want to do is when you have a large estate, 10, 20, 30, doesn't make any difference. They don't want to pay any federal estate tax, or at least use all of the proper tools that are used that the Internal Revenue Service allows to cut that estate down to as little as possible. And if you do it properly, you can
mm-hmm.
go ahead and not pay any estate tax if, in fact, you do it within the context of the tax code. But you've got to work with top-of-the-line people, and that's what I do. I assemble top-quality attorneys, CPAs, whatever else, to make sure that that mission is accomplished. And that's kind of what I do. But that's also applicable for people who are in smaller estates. But my job is to deliver those two items.
Now,
so, mm-hmm.
what these families, why do they need a specialist like you? A family, an uber wealth family. Why do they need you? Why can't they do this themselves?
Primarily because they don't know how and who to go to. First
they don't have
foremost,
these connections, do they?
They don't have the connections. For example, we just were talking to Louis. Louis and I work together because we have the ability to go ahead and find the best attorneys in the country who are going to resolve a specific client's problem. So therefore, who's the best attorney? Who's the most gifted attorney? Who's the most gifted CPA? Who's the most gifted office, family office that can make these things happen for a client? So that's what we do. We know who all the connections are. For example, here in the Silicon Valley, I might use someone like, I use a name here or two. I hope you kind of forgive me. But
please. We drop names on this show. Absolutely.
Okay. So
absolutely.
there's a man by the name of like Robert Bjorn. Robert Bjorn is one of the best attorneys in the Silicon Valley. and he has a lot. He's gifted and has an awful lot of good answers for a specific type of problem. If it's a different kind of problem, I might go to someone like in the Los Angeles area. Bring him here. And the person I use in the Los Angeles area is an attorney by the name of Mr. Inouye, Edward Inouye. And on the other hand, because I've got clients all over the country, in the New York area or back east, I bring on someone like Edward Wren, who's one of the best attorneys, period. So I bring the very talented to the client, so therefore we make sure he has the top talent to work with to accomplish the things that he wants for his family. But the amazing thing on this, what's coming up is, between the year 2001 and 2010, families that had a net worth of about $5 million or more are expected to grow by 27%. So right now at the end of this time period, there's 2 million households who are considered to be multimillionaire people. By the year 2010-2011, there's going to be twice as many people who are going to be worth in the neighborhood of $25 trillion. So it's growing. But along with this increase has been a huge change or a huge increase in the complexity of managing the wealth. When you think of all the things you've got to think about, you've got to think about the law. You've got to think about what's the implication for income taxes, especially if when we have a new president, they want to raise those income taxes. That affects you and I. The last time people have done their wills or trusts, I find even the very wealthy, their estate was not put together no sooner, let's say, 5 or 10 years ago. So they're so out of date that they're not taking advantage of all the new things that are happening in the estate tax arena. So that's why specialists like me work with Louis Sheff and work with all these gifted other advisors to deliver what the client is trying to do. There are very few people that do what we do. Because it is so complex, and that's why.
Okay, now, and the major concern that high net worth households have, what are they? What are their major concerns?
My experience has shown that there's probably four key areas. First and foremost, I would say that, and these are beyond the investments that they make. I would say that they want to go ahead and control the level of risk. In other words, they want to minimize the income taxes, but they want to take the least amount of risk. So it's wealth enhancement. We specialize in doing that. Number two, what is the best and most efficient way of transferring assets to your children? Because that's the biggest concern when you see that the federal estate tax, you know, when you die, and if you happen to die, let's say after the year 2011, the federal government wants 55% of your estate.
Isn't that amazing?
Well, when you think about it, it's galling. It really upsets a lot of people when Lewis was talking about the fact that some of these folks work 70, 80 hours a week, and they take all of this risk to try to gather all this capital, and sometimes they go bankrupt, they're worried, they're doing all these things, and after they do this and they wind up passing away, let's say, 80, 90 years of age, and then the Internal Revenue Service wants to come in, or the Congress, not the Internal Revenue Service, wants to take away 55% of your estate that you work for very hard. You've been paying sales taxes. Every time you get a paycheck, you pay income taxes. When you buy something at the supermarket or whatever you buy, you got to pay more sales taxes. You
Correct.
Got property taxes. So I think someone said to John McCain, "What do I do? They tax me when I'm alive. They tax me when I'm asleep. They tax me when I'm buying food. They tax me when I die. How much tax is enough?" So what we do, we go ahead and take a look at the code, see what can be done, and eliminate the estate tax for our clientele. But those kind of procedures can be used for the smaller estates also. But you've got to find that kind of person. That's what we do. We review the attorneys. find out how good they really are. It'll be your attorney, your CPA, and are they up to knowing how to do that? And so therefore, we're hired to take a look at these legal folks and find out whether or not they can handle that kind of job. I've got a client who has a corporate attorney who did the living trust and the estate plan. They're two different kinds of law, and I'm not sure why. And this is a large estate. Why would his corporate attorney?
But is he qualified to write them both?
I don't think so. I have not met that man. So
could it be because they're familiar with the person?
I would say they're familiar with the person, and so therefore, I think that to do estate planning takes a very special training area within the law because it's so complex. I know that being a corporate attorney is also very complex. There are almost two sets of laws. So I don't discount that attorney. I sit down and talk with him or her, and let's see how knowledgeable they really are. Because some of the things that we happen to work in, people have never even heard of before. So let's see how much they actually know.
I don't see how they could be qualified to work on both ends of that problem. It's impossible, I think.
Well,
now it looks to me you sound like a problem solver. Is that correct?
That's exactly what I do. I sit down with a client and say
you're a fixer.
yes, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, you're a fixer.
But you see, it makes it such a rewarding business that I'm involved in. What I do is just a lot of fun. I know you shouldn't have fun at your work, but it's really enjoyable because you're always working at the very cusp of knowledge. And you see people when they realize what's available out there and how it can be used, there's just joy in their face. That it's just a very rewarding industry just to work in. But the complexity of it is sometimes it's almost overwhelming.
Boy, it seems a little complicated. So how does a regular person like myself know what exactly you're doing? If
we
hired you and we said, okay, here, do this project, how do we know what you're doing?
Well, that's a really good question. I would say that I do, I become like your teacher. So therefore, every time a legal document is presented to you, and when you take a look at it, it's almost very difficult to read. For example, we happen to use a lot of defective grantor trusts. And most people say, I don't want a defective one. I want one that works. And you say, well, no. It's defective. It sounds like it's complicated. And so, therefore, after the attorney draws up the documentation, you ask his permission if I can go ahead and decipher this for you in ordinary English. So, therefore, my job is to break the very complicated concepts and legal documents and income taxes and investments. And my job is to break that down to a component that you understand. So we start.
You're an interpreter.
It's true. It's very much like I think, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, but in the play of Julius Caesar, and I think
yes.
It was Marlon Brando playing.
That's not disrespectful. I understand exactly what you're saying.
And so what happened? One of his lines was, "It's all Greek to me," and that's where that line comes from. But when people read these documents, the language that is used is almost it's confusing. So therefore, you go up on the board, and you bring a piece of chalk with you, and you start to break that down in ordinary English, and you don't step away until a client that begins to understand it. Because if the client does not understand what he's signing, he's not going to sign it until he thoroughly understands what exactly the impact is going to be. In some cases, it's so complicated. I have to go over that probably five or six times until finally the client has one of those aha moments.
Yes.
Whereby they say, oh, now I understand. Why doesn't it say so? Well, it does. But it is so structured and it has to be so specific that it has to be done a specific way. So therefore, it's a movement of exploration and understanding exactly what it means. And I know people have a difficult time even reading their living trusts. So you sit down and you read line by line until you answer everybody's questions. and then you do it one more time. So it's almost like giving a quiz, but it is,
yes.
It isn't really. It's more so you really understand what the impact is. And then the next question is, what else could be done? So therefore, my job is constantly completing an understanding of what's been written, and does it match what the client is trying to do? For example, you may say, I want to reduce my estate tax down to zero. How do I do that? So all of these very complicated legal instruments are put together, things like family limited partnerships, LLC companies, defective trusts, dynasty trusts, mega trusts. It's like trust land. So what the attorneys do, they kind of reach into the sky and pull these trusts together and string them together so they make sense. And that turns out to be the plan that we're trying to do. And then my job is to break it down. Now, once the client agrees to whatever they agree to, my job is to make sure that that is completed and signed properly. I have been with clients whereby, as a matter of fact, I'm working with an attorney right now who put together a living trust for one of his very favorite clients, and the client has not signed that legal document for 4 years. And the attorney didn't know that. And it's just a simple living trust. And I asked the client, why didn't you sign it? He said, I didn't sign it because, you know, to tell you the truth, I didn't understand it. And so then we went through the process of breaking it down so that they understood, or understand rather.
Did he sign it then?
Yes, he did. It's a lady.
Oh, that matters. That matters.
And so therefore the reason it was important, because if she passed away, it would have to go through the probate process, and the kind of business that she's in would have fallen apart because she is the business. So by the time it became unraveled in the probate court, her business would have been destroyed. Number two, it has children. Who's going to take care of the children? Who's going to be the guardians? Nothing had been signed, and she was just afraid to admit to the attorney that she just didn't understand it. And I see that a lot. Where I'm inside with an attorney and with the client, and the attorney's explaining something, and he said, do you understand? And they all shake their head. Yes, I do. And then as I walk out the door, I said, what part did you not understand? They said, all of it? So therefore, I make an appointment.
And because they're on the spot, they'll say, yes, I do understand.
Yeah, they have all kinds of reasons as to why they say yes, but generally they'll say, you know, I really didn't understand it, Raymond. I just a little embarrassed because he's using all these legal terms. And I said, I can understand. Let's make an appointment next week, and I'll ask the attorney if it's okay if I summarize that for you. And the attorney is more than happy to do that. The important thing is that the client understands it. So that's kind of how I'm used by the attorneys and the clients.
Well, from what Lewis Schiff was saying and from what you're telling me now, it sounds like you work with a lot of advisors. How do you decide with a particular family what group you're going to pull together? Because it sounds like you put together a specific group with specific talents that you wouldn't do the same group, the same team. You don't take them to the next family, do you?
No. And that's because different temperaments.
You're handpicking them?
They're almost like custom-made because some clients are very business-like. So they like facts. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Get right to the chase. Show me how that works.
You were saying temperament,
Different temperaments. Other people are a little bit more soft-spoken, and some people are very chatty. So therefore, it has to be tailored. But the one common quality that they have is they're at the highest caliber. And so, number two, make sure that their talents are within the expertise that we're looking for. So therefore, it must be a matching of the client, so it's kind of a mix and match.
Mm-hmm.
And so you wouldn't think that you say, well, an attorney is an attorney. Some attorneys shine in one area and they don't shine in another area. So therefore, if the client needs the expertise in the second part, then I have to bring that attorney on board. Some attorneys explain very well. Some attorneys are very chatty. So it all depends on so it's more than just understanding the law. So we have to pull the team together and agree as to what the client is trying to do, and deliver the best we can possibly do to get whatever they're looking for.
Where do you meet these experts, Raymond?
Where do I meet them?
I
meet them in all kinds of situations, and I'm constantly...
But tell us about your background, because your background was very fascinating and very interesting, where you went to school and the people you know.
Well, I started out at Stanford, and
mm-hmm.
then I eventually wound up as an analyst in New York, working for Dean Witter Reynolds, many, many years ago. Then
mm-hmm.
I came out back to California and started out with Prudential. And then I decided, I really do something different than pick individual securities, because most of my clients are large accounts. So therefore,
mm-hmm.
I just, that's kind of what I've been doing for almost 20-some-odd years. So luckily for me, the kind of a client that I draw or is attracted to me is generally someone who's a very large account, who has very special estate tax problems, or, wants to go ahead and reduce the income taxes. And they happen to want top-of-the-line answers. But when you get above $25 million,
mm-hmm.
the kind of answers that are available are dramatically different than the smaller accounts. And they're different because they're trying to do something that is not common among the smaller accounts. The smaller accounts may have some estate tax issues, but not at the same level.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, it's for me, it's much more fun doing the larger accounts. But in some cases, I'm doing the same thing for a $50 million account as I'm doing someone for, let's say, for smaller, let's say around $10 million. So therefore, all of the experience and the knowledge that I gather among the higher the $50 million and $100 million accounts, I filter that down to the smaller accounts, and so they're given information that is really normally only available to the extreme wealthy. So if you're a smaller account, you're still getting the same kind of information, and you're still bringing the same kinds of teams together, and that's what I do. So people like Lewis, he's attracted to the fact that I tend to have a variety of clients, and I just have a tremendous amount of knowledge in estate planning. So,
are you a tax attorney, actually, or you're
no.
you're an attorney, aren't you?
No, I'm not. Actually, when I
was
at the university,
CPA? I want to know what type of because the things that you do and the plans that you're setting up. I mean, something sets you apart from these other financial planners. What is that?
I really am a certified financial planner, and you can find
ah.
a website to actually double check that. But I do much more than that.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that the average financial advisor or planner generally concentrates primarily in how to go ahead and make the estate grow, how to manage the money. And so that's a lot of what we do, but we go way beyond that.
So what experience did you say you do have?
Well, what experience? Well, I've got those problems myself, first and foremost. Number
yeah.
two, I... throughout the years, I've been dealing with so many attorneys and so many CPAs that saw this kind of problem that I just have grown in the amount of knowledge that I possess. So therefore, I take all it's. I guess I can really say something. Sum it up in one word: I have a tremendous amount of experience dealing in this arena,
mm-hmm.
and that's because I've worked in this arena for so long that I really do understand how this process works.
Why don't you explain some of the estate planning tools that you use? I'm asking because this is terribly interesting. And what did I say? You're going to need a lot more time. What did you say? Oh no! Did we not have that conversation?
Yes, we did.
Uh huh. And we are down to the last 15 minutes. See what I mean? What you're saying is so important. You know what we're going to do? I'm going to ask you, these couple of questions.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what I'm going to do? I'm known for being an aggressive interviewer and an aggressive businesswoman, and
mm-hmm.
I don't care. I'm going to stop apologizing for it. So
mm-hmm.
I'm basically going to emotionally arm wrestle you into the Blog Talk Radio family. And you're going to show up every Tuesday with one of these wonderful people that you are connected with. What do you say about that?
Well, I think it's I think it's something that most Americans would want to know. How do the wealthy really do a lot of these things?
And but there isn't enough time. We need you here more often. We need you here more often. I want to know if you will commit to coming every Tuesday and making it the Raymond Rivas night.
I'll be more than happy to do that because I've got a passion for this. I have a passion for people to learn how to save taxes. I have a passion for people to make their estate grow. If you're a smaller estate, I want you to grow, so therefore you become the ultra rich. If you're the ultra rich, I have a passion so that therefore when you have these assets in the business that you're working in or the real estate that you happen to own, how can you make it work more effective? Do you have a business plan? And so therefore what I enjoy and what I want to happen with the clients that I work with and the clients I'm going to work in the future is to be the best they can become in making their assets grow and taking care of their family. And that's what my life is all about, is to deliver that for my clientele. So
when something happens, you protect that money so that it's not lost when the parent passes away. The child, or in other words, you protect the entire estate.
That's true. And I'll give an example. I have a client in Wyoming, and there were somewhere like around $50 million. The estate tax, if they happen to pass away, let's say in the year 2011, was about $27 million. And so the IRS keeps 27, and they keep 23. If, in fact, the $23 million is then given to their children and they pass away, it's going to be cut again to about $12 million because it'll be taxed again at the 55 cents. But if you work with a talented team like Lewis, myself, and some of these attorneys that I've mentioned, this is what can happen. You take that $50 million that you have. You put that into some very special boxes that are put together by the attorneys. And there might be family limited partnerships, LLCs, whatever it turns out to be. We then go ahead and we use things like mega trust, dynasty trust. These are all tools out of the toolkit so that, therefore, when it's all said and done, when the client passes away, the estate tax may be $1.5 million, maybe zero. If we buy the right kind of life insurance, we may even make a profit. So, therefore, if we do it that way, the family keeps the $50 million, and so that is put into a trust that will continue to be in their families, that will give them protection far beyond anything they've ever seen. And so, therefore, they may not ever have to pay income or estate taxes, rather, ever again. It can go from generation to generation without being reduced. And then we make sure that it becomes divorce-proof, so that, therefore, if your daughter marries somebody and that person walks out, we make sure that the person that they divorced never gets a dime. It's protected that way. And when that child passes away, there'll be no estate tax. They then can give it to the grandchildren, and there's no estate tax. It can go from generation to generation without paying estate taxes if it's put together a very specific way. And that's what we do for families and show them how to do this. The point is, your estate will not shrink, and if it shrinks, it's going to shrink very little. And that's what we do.
That's a wonderful gift to have. What a wonderful I can see many families would be flocking to come to get your services.
Well, it takes a lot of work. But again,
in your experience, Raymond, what are the concerns that the ultra-wealthy want addressed? What do they want handled?
What do they want handled? Well, I think first and foremost, what I just said is they don't want to pay. They want to reduce the estate tax to as little as possible. That seems to be the overwhelming item that they have in mind. The second thing that they want to do is they want to protect their children. They want to take care of their heirs. When they protect the wealth, as you can see, making the money is not their only concern. They also want strategies for protecting the wealth that they've earned. Nearly three-quarters of the people that I know, this is what they're hearing over and over again. People are concerned about losing their money. Well, most say that, you know, that that they hear over and over again. Some of the folks that I work with, that they're afraid of being sued, losing their money, and being sued are major concerns. And then lastly, like Lewis was talking about, they need to have adequate medical insurance to cover those enormous healthcare costs, which I think most of us are going to be facing, you know, down the road. When they're concerned about taking care of their children, as you can see, people are looking beyond their own needs, and they're looking down for future generations. And so, therefore, taking care of their children is the very most important for most wives and mothers. And so, therefore, another key concern is making sure that your children and grandchildren's education is paid for. And so those are seem to be the two main things. And then obviously the last thing is reducing the taxes. And that seems to be not quite at the very top, but it's one of the top three. Protecting the wealth, take care of your kids, and reduce the taxes. That's what I see.
Now, one thing that I'm really interested in, because this interests me personally,
mm-hmm.
Business opportunities when you're talking about estate planning. What do you mean?
Well,
like, you want them to consider business opportunities?
Yes. I'll go back to the person in Wyoming as a good example.
Mm-hmm.
This specific person is in the area of selling real estate.
Okay.
But his business plan is less than stellar. So, therefore, what we're working is on a business plan that can be structured whereby the numbers are double checked rather than coming out of their head. We work with the CPA, so the numbers are real, so he can actually see what it's really going to be costing. He needs to go ahead and put together a business plan, so therefore he can show it to the banks and show it to venture capitalists. And more important, he clarifies what he's trying to do. And so therefore, that's one client. I have another client who has a corporation, and he's trying to have his corporation become a $500 million company. But he has a very difficult time explaining what he's trying to do. So therefore, we come in with a staff of people, put together a top-of-the-line business plan, so that therefore he understands what he's trying to do, and then he can shop that around. So therefore, he can show people what he's trying to do in a very clear manner. Now, for some other people, let's say the commonality is that people who are starting out want to become rich. Is that true?
Always.
The rich people, they want to make their assets continue to grow. The
Absolutely.
Commonality between the two is how to make their assets grow more is to come up with a well thought out comprehensive plan that they can follow. I would say that when people don't plan, they don't succeed anywhere near what they could succeed, and that all comes from the fact that they really don't have any planning that they have put together, in any sort of logical manner. So therefore, if you follow your plan, then the chances are that your dreams will be realized. But you got to sit down and think about it very carefully. So I do that with all my clients. So it's just not a matter of putting together estate plans or investing the money. I'm trying to find out, what are you trying to do with your own business? What can you do with the capital that you happen to have that's going to slingshot you, so therefore you become one of those middle-class, well, multimillionaires? And so that's what we try to do with every client.
That is fascinating. That's fascinating.
It's a
lot
of fun.
Now, what are you talking about, when you were telling me before, you were saying, you want a person to have an action plan or a timeline. What did you mean by that?
Well, when I say timeline, I'm talking about when you actually put together an estate plan. What happens is when the attorneys talk to you,
mm-hmm.
There are several agreements that are made. And so, therefore, you might be doing discounts. You might be doing some of these things that are required. But there's no one saying, well, you got to do this in 3 weeks, 3 months. So timelines have to be met. So my job is kind of be the captain to make sure that the attorney does what he's supposed to do when he's supposed to do it, making sure that the client goes ahead and signs the documents as they should be signed, making sure that if they do that defective trust, that it is seated properly, making sure that instead of having that client who I was telling you earlier, where they had this living trust done, and four or 5 years later they still haven't signed it, we make sure that's signed and find out if they're not signing it, the reasons why. So someone's got to watch those timelines to make sure that the from the start, from the beginning to the actual signing or the completion, that it's done on a very timely basis. That's what I'm talking about.
Fantastic. And for those of you who are listening, those that love us both, both Raymond Rivas and myself, I just wanted to let you know, don't worry about Raymond Rivas. If you're thinking that I'm twisting his arm to come onto Syndicated News and join us, he and I have been talking about
it.
Yes, he did. I'm getting a lot of flack from all directions, from the East Coast and the West Coast, saying, what are you hurting him? You have him in a headlock. Let him go.
No,
actually,
I want to do it. It's just a lot of fun for me, and
yes.
I really want the American people to become as educated as they possibly can. I want people to succeed. That's the underlying story. I want people to do very well. I want them to have the best talent, so therefore they make the best decisions. I want them to understand how to make money. I want them to understand how to work within the guidelines of the Internal Revenue, the IRS rules, and still not pay any taxes. So I want
and
to reveal
that's
these.
That's why Raymond Rivas is going to join Syndicated News, and Tuesday night is going to be the Raymond Rivas night, and he's going to bring his guests on. And if I can't begin to give you the list of people that this man knows, because you wouldn't believe it. If I told you now, you wouldn't believe it. So I'm going to leave it alone, and we're going to surprise you on Tuesday because we don't even know who he's going to show up with. And get ready for that. Tuesday night is Raymond Rivas night, and we're going to have our sportscaster join us soon as well. Our sportscaster, by the way, doesn't have permission. He can't drive. He's only 10. And he's a very, very bright boy. He's got excellent grades, and that's why he's our sportscaster. And this week, the coming week, we're going to have his, we're going to air his little sports program because he's getting his career in sports with us. And we're going to have our wonderful chef join us. It's going to be a program, a segment called Fine Living. We're still working on that. But Syndicated News on Blog Talk Radio is growing. And since our audience is interested in return on investment more than anything else, that's the information we're going to give them. People grow their wealth if they have the right information. And you couldn't get better information than by having Raymond Rivas here every Tuesday night. Would you agree?
I think so.
Anyway, let's wrap it up because this is Blog Talk Radio on Syndicated News. And we've come to the end of the night. This has been an excellent evening. I can't tell you how grateful I am. I've loved
you,
this evening. I've loved this evening. Well, we've got a whole minute. I've learned so much. And I can't wait to see the guests you're going to bring on Tuesdays. Tuesday is going to be a marvelous night. I guarantee you I'll be home every night listening to the show because I'll be fascinated. I want to learn how to build wealth and keep it. And I'm very, very grateful to Louis Schiff and yourself that you were so gracious to allow us to move you to the 11 o'clock segment. I can't thank you enough. Such nice gentlemen. And I guess, Raymond, I guess I'll see you. I mean, we'll talk after the show, after, you know, we close the show in about 5 seconds.
Okay.
And I'll have to say good night. From Blog Talk Radio, this is Syndicated News with Raymond Rivas and Louis Schiff and Ruthie DiTucci. And this is us. Good night.
Good night. Good night.
I'll call you.
Bye-bye.